Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Are we in the midst of a new renaissance in publishing, with ebooks and self-published authors having access to put their works out to the world? Well, founder and CEO of Smashwords, Mark Coker, believes so. He joins us to provide a bird's eye view of the publishing industry. The publishing industry has been traditionally controlled by five main publishers. But today, with all the ebooks and the self-published authors having the ability to reach greater and larger audiences, that control is going away. And he's going to talk about the industry and how it's fundamentally impacting our world. And it's really a fascinating discussion. And after we go through that, we're going to be joined by Elad Levinson, and he's going to talk about thriving on change. And I think it's a perfect discussion after talking about the changes in the publishing industry, because there really isn't greater changes that can affect our society than publishing. It's kind of like the printing press. And I think Elad, his new initiative called Thriving on Change is such a great thing and timely thing to be discussing right now. We have a lack of leadership in the country and around the world, and it's really an important issue right now, and it's really affecting us in a lot of ways. We have such bad behavior going on everywhere, and it needs to be taken care of somehow. And I'm hoping people like Elad can make a difference and can really get our business world leading in a positive way and developing leaders. But for now, you know, we'll get into that. But for now, let's talk to Mark Coker from Smashwords. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Glad to be here.
The book publishing industry and ebooks has gone through a complete metamorphosis. And that is not an exaggeration. The whole industry is kind of doing a big turn here. And, you know, it's been like that probably ever since the internet started. But can you give the listeners an overview of kind of where the market and how it's turned in the last 10 years, just so we can give a base to go from before we dive Sure. into the interview?
Sure. Well, about 10 years ago, the book publishing industry was completely controlled by, large traditional book publishers in New York. It was a print-centric business. 10 years ago, essentially 100% of all book sales were in print. So publishers controlled the printing press, they controlled the access to retail distribution, and they also controlled all the expertise necessary for professional publishing.
And how many publishers would you say that was?
Well, there are thousands of publishers in the world, but it was, 10 years ago, it was the big six publishers that really controlled most of the market.
Okay, so it was really six different. So this whole industry is a huge change.
Yeah, the publishing industry has undergone a lot of consolidation over the last 20 years. So, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, New York was characterized by a lot of, smaller mid-size independent presses, but a lot of those companies got rolled up into larger conglomerates.
Okay.
Some of which are owned in New York and some are owned overseas. It's a very small handful of publishers. They were referred to, up until a couple of years ago as the big six, but now they're the big five after Penguin and Random House merged together.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's what the world looked like 10 years ago. about 7 years ago, 7-8 years ago, ebooks were still a very small piece of the overall market. You know, we launched Smashwords in 2008 at a time when ebooks accounted for about 0.5% of the market. But around 2008, Amazon launched with ebooks and the Kindle. And that was also around the time prior to Amazon, Sony launched with their e-reader. But with Amazon's entry into the market really started growing, and ebooks started growing exponentially. So what we've seen over the last 7 years is that ebooks have gone from, you know, 0.5% of the overall book market to where they are today, probably in the 25% to 30% range. No one really knows the exact number.
And isn't it considerably more amongst the young people? Because I know that in my class that I taught last fall at the university, the book was available online, and very few college kids even ordered the text version. They just did it online.
Well, I think for trade books, you know, the types of books outside of education, books that you would buy in a bookstore, I think the market still skews a little bit older. I know some of the very first early adopters of Amazon's Kindle were middle-aged people, you know, people 40 and up, people who appreciated the ability to be able to click a button and increase the font size.
That's probably true, right?
Of the e-reading device.
Because you become blind as you get older.
Yeah.
It's not funny, actually.
it's one of the killer features of ebooks is that you can adjust the font size. Reading becomes more pleasurable and more accessible to more readers. But you know, we're seeing strong adoption of ebooks across all age ranges. But you know, the strongest genre in ebooks right now is romance, and romance is generally read by women and is very popular with middle-aged women. Although, you know, there's also, you know, young adult romance is also very popular. So it's difficult to dangerous to overgeneralize. One of the neat things, though, that happened with the rise of ebooks is that it enabled self-publishing to become viable for the first time. Print self-publishing has been around for decades. Dan Pointer has been talking about print self-publishing for 30 years and training authors how to publish professionally, but it wasn't until ebooks came along that self-publishing became viable, because prior to ebooks, it was impossible for print self-publishers to get widespread distribution in bookstores.
Well, wasn't it just hard to get through those pearly gates too? I mean, writers getting through to the 5 or 6 major publishers, it would have been very difficult unless you know someone or somebody happens to like your work. Pass up on a lot of really good artists.
Well, definitely. It's always been difficult for writers to find a publisher that will take a chance on them, and it's getting more and more difficult. So the authors who chose to self-publish in print typically failed to reach readers because they didn't have access to the bookstores. Only publishers can get you into the bookstores. But that's why everything changed with ebooks, because with ebooks, the major ebook retailers wanted to carry every single book, and they allowed self-published authors to have their books in their stores. And, you know, that's a huge change in the market that Smashwords was very instrumental in carrying out here. We helped open up ebook distribution.
And you're the largest distributor, aren't you, of indie?
Yeah.
Ebooks. So yeah. You've kind of led the way in this whole new, you know, marketplace that's forming.
We've been instrumental. You know, we are the world's largest distributor of self-published ebooks. We're publishing over 350,000 books from over 100,000 authors and small independent presses around the world. You know, we were the first to open up Barnes & Noble and Sony to self-published ebooks. You know, now it's completely common that, you know, every retailer will carry self-published ebooks. They want to carry everything. You know, the big change that was enabled by the move to digital, to online sales, is that the stores have unlimited shelf space for ebooks. That's not the case in a brick and mortar bookstore where they can only carry a limited number of titles.
And they have to clear it out with the ones that aren't selling, and they have to take a discount. It's this constant cycle.
Yeah, it's a constant churn where books that are not selling well get returned to the publisher for a full refund. They're effectively forced out of print. You know, thousands, tens of thousands of high-quality books have been forced out of print simply because the brick-and-mortar bookstores don't have the shelf space to carry, you know, hundreds of thousands of books. You know, even a large Barnes & Noble can only carry maybe 70,000.
Well, with that being said, is it easy to publish on your own now? I suppose easy isn't a good word, but is it doable in a, you know?
Well, see, the thing is, print self-publishing has always been easy to do, but it was also too easy to be able to fill up your garage with unsold books. You know,
well, it's easy to fail, too, right? That's what you're saying.
It's impossible to sell, very difficult to sell books. E-books have made self-publishing easier than ever. If your manuscript is finished today, you can publish it today and start selling it today to a worldwide audience. You know, but, Smashwords, five minutes from upload, your book is for sale. So the publishing part is easier than ever. The selling part is still difficult. It's not
easy
to sell books.
The marketing game is where it's at right now, right? I mean, you still, the formula is you have to, first of all, you have to make a really good book, right? That has always been the case. But
that's the most important thing is you've got to write a super awesome book that takes the reader to emotionally satisfying extremes.
And then after that, marketing it, that's really hard. But hasn't the traditional publishers moved away from providing services like marketing? You have to do it yourself anyway, so why would you even publish with the traditional publisher?
Well, you know, traditional publishers do a lot for you. You know, they pay you money up front for your book. They give you an advance. They invest their talent and expertise into the book. They provide editing. They package the book, cover design. They do sales and distribution and marketing and promotion. That's what authors expect from publishers. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, on the marketing and promotion side, only a small subset of their authors get heavy marketing and promotion. If your book is not selling well, then they're not going to give you a lot of support because they've just got too many other books to support.
And if they screw up on how they're going to market it and so it doesn't work very well, then their mistake and their incompetence causes them to drop you and think it's the book's not of value.
Well, certainly that happens all the time. You know, when you sell your book to a publisher, you're giving up all of the rights to that publisher. The publisher controls the book. They decide what happens with that book. Certainly, if your publisher doesn't support you, the book could bomb. If the publisher is wonderful, then the book could be successful. It's a risk that you take working with a publisher. If you're going to self-publish, you assume the responsibility,
which is hard anyways, right?
And it's all on you.
And a lot of writers aren't very good at marketing anyways. So you wouldn't even know if the publisher was bad because you might not be very good either.
Yeah. So, you really have to look at all the different sides to it. You know, a lot of authors will blame the publisher and think that it's the publisher's fault that their book didn't sell, when the reality of the matter is it's the book's fault. The book didn't resonate with the target audience. So you never know. It's always a combination of factors. But, you know, when we're talking about, you know, one of the great things today is that there's never been a better time to be a writer. You can start a book today with 100% assurance that one way or another, it will be published, whether you self-publish it or you sell it to a traditional publisher. And as you mentioned already, you know, nothing's more important than the book. the book needs to sell itself. The book is really your best marketing because books sell based on word of mouth. And if your book inspires word of mouth, then it'll sell well. And then the piece of bookstore distribution, that was always really important. We talked about all those books that were forced out of print too early. They lost distribution. Well, that's no longer a problem. So that important piece of the puzzle on the ebook side has been solved for self-published authors. Your book will land on that retail shelf and it'll stay there forever. Your book is immortal. And then it's up to the book. It's up to the cover image, and to really sell the book.
Can you make money, or is it always just like 1% of the people making money?
If you want to make money in publishing, you should get a job at McDonald's. That's really the truth of the matter, and people should not get into this business to make money. That's the wrong reason to do it.
Why do you get into this business? Why would you do this?
You do this because you're a writer, because you need to write, because you love to write, because you love to publish, you love to connect directly with your audience, with your readers. You love to touch readers with your words and your intelligence and your knowledge. So you should write and publish because you love to do that, because that's your passion. Those are the authors who will achieve the greatest financial success. You know, the writers who get into this thinking they're going to make a quick buck, they're going to fail. They're going to fail very quickly, and they're going to give up very quickly. You know, the life of a writer is tough. It is a tough business. Every single day, you will face 20 reasons to quit. And if you're lucky, only one reason to continue on. The writers who become bestsellers are the ones who always continue on. They power on. They never give up.
Well, it's like being an entrepreneur. It's the same. It's right. That same, you know,
yeah, same thing
tenacity.
As being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, you have to have that that tenacity to just keep going. But
yeah, you've got to have that fire in your belly.
But aren't there other reasons that you can write a book? You know, a lot of businesses could write a book to help their sales for their company, or you know,
definitely.
There's so many different reasons to write a book that complement what they're doing. It's not about making money with the book as much as, you know, helping to get an audience for something else that you're doing, maybe.
Sure, and the credibility. So, you know, let's say you are some subject matter expert and you tour the country, you know, giving seminars and speeches. You should definitely have a book. And you should definitely have that book available in print because you can sell it in the back of the room. And that book, you know, let's say you're a consultant. Let's say I don't know what you consult on. Maybe you consult on, you know, restaurant automation, whatever your expertise is, whatever your niche is, you should write a book and you should share your expertise with the world, and your potential clients will read that book and they'll see that you're an author, and that'll give you more credibility and it'll bring in more business. So, certainly, you know, a book can be a tool that helps you grow your business. You may not necessarily make all your money selling the book, but you're going to make it on the business that comes to you around the book.
Well, I've had someone tell me that if you're going to go and do talks and be a subject matter expert, you have to have a book written. Even if it's a 6-page coloring book, get a book written.
Well, those people who are listening to you speaking, those people who are inspired by you, they want to buy your book. They want to leave that room with a piece of you, and that's the book.
Exactly. And so if you publishing your own book is a route to not necessarily becoming a successful author as much as complementing whatever other industry or business you're in, consulting firms, even financial firms, all sorts of different, you know, executive coaches. There's so many different industries that would benefit from having books.
Right. And so it certainly works that way for nonfiction. If you're a fiction writer,
it's different.
It's completely different because most fiction writers are not, you know, filling up rooms with audiences who want to hear about their fiction.
Trying to become an artist, a movie star or something, right? I mean, it's that same path. It's very difficult. But if that's where your passion lies, then that's where your passion lies, right?
Yeah, you got to go with your passion. And, you know, fiction is what sells best as a book.
Does nonfiction get more money per book or not?
The average fiction book probably sells a lot more than the average nonfiction book.
Are there more nonfiction than fiction, or the other way around?
It's the other way around. You know, I can't speak for the entire industry. I can speak for Smashwords. Probably 70% of the books published at Smashwords are fiction, and about 30% nonfiction. But close to 90% of our sales are fiction.
Okay.
As opposed to nonfiction. And these sales are being driven by readers, the readers who are buying the books. And it's heavily influenced by romance, because that's the number one best-selling genre for ebooks.
Well, how much money can you make? Because I know I've been reading about people giving away their books for free. And when I see that, I'm as a business person, I'm like, well, God, I don't want to do that. It's very difficult for me to ever think free unless there's, you know, I'm giving my podcast away for free. So, okay. But that's because I have.
So you're already benefiting
I get that.
From free.
Yeah, I get that. But free can't be a free forever. There has to be, you know, I have sponsorships and I have other things that I'm doing with my podcast. But free can't be free forever. You have to have a reason to be doing free.
Well, let me share another perspective. I think every author should have at least one free book.
But they have a reason for it, right? You're building, so there's a path to free.
Right. The authors who have a free book are earning more money overall than the authors who don't have a free book. When we look at, for example, authors who write series, and you can write series whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction. Authors who have a free series starter earn probably about 80% more on average
for
the entire series.
But that's your ad. So your first book is an advertisement. You got to look at it as that's your ad and that's your marketing cost. And then the rest are your product. I mean, you know, sure, that's your product too, but you got to look at it as your marketing costs.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it. You're sampling your work. And once you earn the reader's attention and their trust and loyalty, then they'll go off and buy your other books.
Well, it's just like a consultant. They may be giving their books away so they can get consulting business. I mean, you have a reason to do it. But that is marketing costs, and they realize, okay, that the cost to write it, the cost to get it out there, that's our marketing cost. Now we start selling product.
Right. And one of the neat things with ebooks is that you can give that book away for free at no expense. It doesn't cost you anything to print out an ebook. You're giving them a digital file.
Well, and if you already have a series of four books in mind, that can you make your ebook smaller? Let's say your ebook might be the first four chapters of a book, just it's a smaller book, and then the rest of them are larger. Or does that work against you in this market?
You know, that can work against you if the reader feels like you tricked them, like you only gave them a partial teaser. So it's really important that when you give away the free book, that you make it a complete reading experience with a beginning, middle, and end. And if a reader invests their time in that book, that they feel like they got something valuable out of it and weren't just teased and have to go buy something to get the answer to their question.
Okay. So it's you can't have this hanging hook that makes people mad. You got to be
no,
careful.
You can't. You can't.
It has
they,
to be real.
If they invest, you know, 2 or 3 or 10 hours reading your free book, and then they get to the end of the book and you haven't answered the problem that they're looking to answer with that book, then they're going to feel like they just wasted their time on an advertisement. You want to put your best work forward and make your best work free. You know, if you are a subject matter expert in anything, or if you're a great fiction writer, you know, you want your series starter to put your best foot forward. You want to fight to earn and deserve that reader's trust and loyalty.
But let's say you have earned. Let's say you have a book, a four-book series. Your first one's free because the true people that like your series, you think are going to come back and buy your second one. And they feel that you've earned that, and they don't have any problem paying for it. Now, what can you charge for that?
Are you talking what can you charge for books 2, 3, and 4?
Yeah. What can you reasonably charge?
It really
charge?
Depends on the subject matter. So if you're writing fiction, the sweet spot for fiction is probably $2.99, $3.99 per ebook. If you're writing nonfiction, you know, nonfiction is priced higher, so you could be looking at $5.99 to $9.99 for each of the follow-on books. But it really depends on, you know, the value that you're providing the reader. With nonfiction, if you know, most people who read nonfiction are trying to learn knowledge or gain a solution to a problem, and that solution has value to them. And as long as that solution is more valuable, is worth more to them than the price of the book, then purchasing that book becomes a no-brainer.
Well, how does the industry work, though? So you supply ebooks to people. You have a catalog of ebooks, but then so does Barnes and Noble and Amazon and other places. How does that compare? How does all that work?
Well, Smashwords is a distributor, so we make it fast, free, and easy for any writer anywhere in the world to self-publish an ebook, and then we distribute that book to Apple, Barnes and Noble, Kobo, Oyster, Scribd, to public libraries. And so that's what our business is.
So you don't have your own catalog. You help people get it out everywhere.
Well, we have a catalog of over 350,000 books.
So you have a huge catalog.
Yes, and we also sell all of these books on the Smashwords store. So we operate a store. So we help the author get their book out there into the world. And then their book lands on the shelf at all of these different retailers. And then, you know, they can start selling their book at those different retailers.
So if I'm a publisher of an ebook, I could, if I work through you, you would list my book, plus you would get it out to all these other places.
Yes, that's what we do.
But now, would I get a higher percentage from you than I would from Barnes & Noble or Amazon or Apple?
Well, in some cases you will, in most cases not. So Smashwords, you know, we don't charge for our service, but we do take a commission on the sale of the books. So if your book is priced at $9.99 and we sell your book at Apple, for example, Apple's going to take a $3 commission. We're going to take a $1 commission, and you'll get $6.
Now, is that more than you would get if you were doing a traditional published book that is being sold in a brick-and-mortar store?
Certainly. If you were doing a print book through a traditional publisher sold in a bookstore, you'd probably be looking at 12 to 15% of the list price as your royalty.
That's awful!
it's pretty low. And if you were doing an ebook, you'd only be earning 12 to 17% of the list price as your royalty. So compare 15%. Compare 15% of the list price to, you know, 60 to 80% of the list price, which is what you'll get as an ebook author, a self-published ebook author.
Whereas if you sell it through a traditional publisher, now do they publish they'll publish a hardcover or a paper book, but they'll also publish your ebook but give you very little?
Right. The traditional publishers are only paying 25% net for ebooks, which works out to 12 to 17% of the list price.
So would anybody even use a traditional publisher?
Well, it really depends on, you know, who you are as an author, what you're writing about, and what that publisher is going to give you. So, yeah, when you look at just the ebook opportunity, you will earn a royalty rate 5 times higher if you self-publish. But if there are reasons to work with traditional
publishers.
Well,
it's all business, right? It's business. So if they are going to give you something that's of value, they're going to market your book, they're going to do these things, it's more, you'll sell more, and maybe that will be a good way to go. But for most people, I would think it wouldn't be.
It's really case by case. And everyone's definition is different for what they need. If a publisher is going to offer you a $1 million advance on your book, it's probably a good idea to take it.
I think I would do that.
Yeah, but if you've got a great book, you're writing a great book, and or you've written a great book, and the publisher only wants to give you a $5,000 advance, and they want to take your rights forever, maybe that's not a good deal.
Yeah, it's business.
It's business, and so listen to what they'll offer you. But if it's insufficient, you can self-publish it, and you know what you're going to make self-publishing, at least in terms of margin. You don't know how many copies you're going to sell.
Well, can you do the traditional route and do an ebook without using, like, you can do a traditional route with the publisher and self-do your ebook, or do they end up owning your rights and you have to do your ebook through them?
All the big publishers are going to want your digital rights as well as your print rights. And in many ways, your digital rights are even more valuable to them because digital never has to go out of print. There are a very small number of authors, probably less than five, who've managed to do a deal where the author keeps the digital rights and then they let the publisher have the print rights. Because the publisher can get you into bookstores, something you can't do as a self-published author. But we're talking maybe five authors who've managed to do that out of millions.
So that's pretty hard to do. But if you have an independent ebook that's doing great, is the pressure growing for the brick and mortar stores to carry books that that are independently published?
Well, I wouldn't say the pressure is growing, but sure, if you're selling millions of copies of your ebook, then you'll probably be able to get your book into stores.
And you would be one of those five people in the world that could do it.
You'd be one
deal.
Of the small handful. Now, it's more than five people who are getting their books into stores, but the question is, how broad are they getting that distribution? As a self-published author, you can sign up with Ingram, and Ingram will sell your book into stores. But it's a matter of generating the demand for those stores to carry your book. Ingram may not be out there with their sales force promoting your book. They're only going to do that for a small number of authors.
Sure. So there's a way to make this all work, but you need to go do a really good book and you need to create a demand for it in order to be able to do all the things that you want to do.
Right.
So now how do you create a demand for it? How do you get people to read your book once you put it up there? Free? But go ahead.
There are a lot of tricks that you can use that will maximize your opportunity. So to start off, the first thing that you need to do is that you should release your book as a pre-order.
And what does it mean?
So let's talk about how pre-orders work with ebooks. With a pre-order, you get the listing of your book up at the retailers up to 12 months in advance of the book going on sale. For that entire 12 months or 6 months or however long your book is on pre-order, you can accumulate orders, which means you can market your book more effectively in advance. But the real kicker is that at Apple, Barnes & Noble, and Kobo, all of those orders that you accumulate during the pre-order period credit toward your first day's sales rank when your book goes on sale. So let's say your book is up for 12 months, that's 365 days, and you acquired three orders per day for that period of time, that means you're going to get credit for selling about 1,000 copies in a single day. That will cause your book to skyrocket in the bestseller rank. And when your book lands in the bestseller list, it becomes more visible and more desirable to more readers. So definitely do a pre-order. And if you want to learn about pre-orders, you can go to Smashwords, and I've written multiple blog posts on pre-order strategy and how you can use pre-orders to make your next book launch more successful.
That sounds great, but you have to make sure you get it done, right? I mean,
well, the tools are out there. We make the tools available, but it's up to the author to be smart and learn how to use them.
No. You have to make sure your book is done, right? I mean, you don't do it until your book's done.
We can get a pre-order established even before you started writing the book.
But what happens if you don't finish your book in 12 months?
Then you just let your readers down and destroyed your career. You really need to think of this as a long-term career, and you're looking to build relationships with readers and build trust with readers, which means if you're going to put your book up on pre-order, you deliver the book. Now, from the customer perspective, their credit card is not charged until the book is delivered to them. So it's zero risk for the customer.
So it's win-win-win all around, as long as you get your book done.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just saying, if you want to maximize your odds as an author, you need to do a pre-order, and we've got the data that proves that authors who have books born as pre-orders earn more than authors who just publish their book without a pre-order. So that's the first thing you should do as you're planning your world domination here.
The world domination.
Well, aim high. I believe in aiming high.
Yeah, that's high.
If your goal as an author is to reach thousands, millions of readers, you've got to aim high.
I agree with that. Yeah, you always want to aim high.
And it's important for everyone listening to understand that there is a glut of high quality, low cost books on the market. Which means if you're simply writing a good book, good isn't good enough. So that takes me to the next thing. First you got the pre-order. The second thing is you've got to write a super awesome book. If you don't write a book that makes the reader go wow, then your book isn't good enough and it's not going to sell. So that's number two.
And what's a go wow? I mean, I suppose this might be hard for you to articulate, but what would you say?
Well, actually, it's pretty simple. Think about books that you've read in the past where you read them and you were just like, wow, that completely changes my perspective. That changes my life. I loved it. I want to tell my friends about it. Click to any major retailer, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Look at the bestsellers and then look at the reviews for the bestsellers and read. When you read those reviews, you will see the readers using words like, wow. Or that was amazing, or I couldn't put it down, or if we're looking at a nonfiction book, you'll see a lot of the same things. That was amazing. Wow, that changes my perspective on everything.
They get hooked on it, and that's why it works.
Yeah, they're hooked on it. They're leaving 5-star reviews. It's those wow books that generate word of mouth, because again, put yourself. Put on your reader hat and think about the last time you read a book that moved you like that. That book becomes an extension of who you are. You wear it on your sleeve. You promote that book to all your friends and family and business colleagues because you want to help them. You want to share the joy. You want them to experience what you just experienced, this religious epiphany that you just had with this book. You want to share it. That's word of mouth. So it's turning a reader into a fan and turning a fan into a super fan. Your reader becomes your evangelist. That's how you sell a lot of books. Now, if the reader just reads your book and they think, okay, yeah, I got my $10 worth, but it was good. That's not going to sell well. That's not going to generate the word of mouth. So that's tip number two is write the super awesome book. Tip number three is make sure your book is available in all of the different stores. A lot of authors make the mistake of distributing their book on a single retailer, like Amazon. That's a mistake. There are millions of readers that you will never reach at Amazon. You have to be at all of the retailers. The more retailers, the better.
And there's no cost to you to do that, right?
There's no cost. It's free. Again, think back to the dark ages of print publishing where it was your distribution that determined your success. If your book was pulled off of shelves, if readers couldn't discover your book, then your book was forced out of print and you didn't sell any books. But with ebooks, your book is immortal.
Well,
it's kind
of
on every shelf forever.
It's like with normal business, if you're McDonald's and you're on a very busy intersection, you're going to sell more. But if you're in the middle of the desert with nobody on a lonely road, you're not going to sell anything. And go ahead.
Yeah. So Amazon is at a huge intersection. Apple, Barnes & Noble, Kobo also at huge intersections. And then there are smaller retailers that are on smaller intersections. But the point is you can reach all of them efficiently at no cost. All you have to do is just work with a distributor and get your book up and out there.
And if you do the pre-sales, then you can actually be actually listed on the intersection and they don't have to dig for you.
Well, yeah, if you do the pre-order, your book can become more visible to more readers, which is the whole point. The next thing that you want to do is make sure that you've got a super awesome cover. So the cover is the first impression that you make on the reader. And with books, the image on the cover is especially important. You want the image on the cover to make a promise, an honest promise to your target reader. So if your cover doesn't look as good or better than what the big New York publishers are putting out, then your cover's not good enough. We've had instances, and I've got a case study on it. We had an author who simply changed her cover image and nothing else about the book, and she hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, wow.
The book had been on the market for 5 months. It was selling, but not very well. She changed the cover, hit the New York Times bestseller list. Something as small as a cover change can increase your sales.
And Perry, that goes for title too, right?
What's that?
That goes for title too, I would think.
Well, yeah, the title is very important. You know, targeting, knowing who your target reader is very important. A lot of authors will make the mistake thinking, you know, my book should be read by every single human being on the planet. You know, it's great to think big like that, but that's too big. You want to be targeted, not just targeted, but micro-targeted. Who is the target reader for your book? Who is going to get the most joy, the most benefit from your book?
Niche marketing.
Niche marketing. So do that. And so make sure that the title is consistent with that, the book description is consistent with that, and the categorization is consistent with that.
And is there another thing, or is that pretty much the formula?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things. You know, these things that we're talking about, they all fall underneath the umbrella of best practices. I wrote a book on ebook publishing best practices. It's called The Secrets to Ebook Publishing Success, and you can go and download it for free everywhere. It's always been free. I identify 30 best practices of the best-selling authors. So I would encourage people to go out there and download it and read it. It'll teach you how to think and act like a professional publisher. It'll teach you how to make your book stand out, you know, on those crowded shelves against millions of other books. What you'll find is that, you know, the thing with best practices is that there's not a single magic bullet that will catapult you to bestsellerdom. It's all about doing many things right and avoiding the mistakes. And, you know, I talk about those things in my secrets book.
And you can't take the shortcuts when it comes to the product, because people, they're too intimate with the product. You just can't. It's a basic business concepts, except your product has to be absolutely wonderful. So what do you think is the future of ebooks? Do you think it'll completely take over printed books, or do you think it'll be the majority, or where do you see the whole industry going?
Well, right now, I think the market has reached a point of equilibrium where about, you know, maybe 30% of all book sales are ebooks. I'm talking about dollar volume, and about 70% print books. I think ebooks will continue to grow their market share in the years ahead, but the rate of growth is going to be much slower than it has in the past. I think the early adopters of ebooks have adopted. But for self-published authors, ebooks will continue to account for probably 95% of their sales for most authors.
So,
because that print market's not available to the average self-published author.
Well, you know, most industries go through an early adopter, and they're the change agents, and then there's fast followers, and then the bulk of the rest of the people join in. And when the bulk of the rest of the people join in, there's a revolutionary change. It's just a whole paradigm shift in the marketplace. Now, do you think we've already gone through that where the bulk of the people, or do you think that's still waiting to happen?
I think the bulk of people have transitioned that are going to transition. you know, what we saw in the early years was exponential growth. You know, when I started Smashwords in 2008, ebooks were 0.5% of the market. And then they grew to 1%, then 3%, then 8%, and, you know, 15, 20%, 30% where we're at today. But for the last 2 years, ebook market share has been pretty stagnant. And that's why, you know, I think that we've reached the state of equilibrium. Now, it's actually beneficial and healthy for the long-term, you know, viability of publishing that we have these multiple formats. So even though we only do ebooks at Smashwords, I'm glad that print is maintaining its strength. I want print to maintain its strength. It's great that readers have multiple options for enjoying and accessing books. Many readers read both ebooks and print books. You know, the more formats, the more accessible we make books, the better.
Well, how does libraries come into this? Because I know there's a big debate on libraries, and they're struggling a little bit with the whole e-format, mainly because of the cost that has been forced on them. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, so many libraries are now doing ebooks. They're operating ebook checkout systems, and many of those systems are actually provided by a company like Overdrive, which manages ebook checkout systems for over 20,000 public libraries, and there are other services that manage these checkout systems as well. We're distributing to Overdrive and to these major aggregators, which means that, you know, once your book is at Smashwords, your book can be purchased by libraries. Now, traditional publishers, the large publishers in New York, have not been very friendly to libraries. They're overcharging for their ebooks. But that's not the case in the self-publishing community. Self-published authors and small independent presses have been much more library-friendly, with books that are more affordable on better terms for libraries. So, you know, we're seeing growth in the library market. It's still a small piece of the overall market, but I think libraries have a bright future with ebooks if they can, you know, overcome some of the initial challenges here.
Yeah, because they're starting to embrace the whole indie market because it's priced right, but the traditional publishers, because, you know, I was reading something that they'll charge something like $4 for a printed book, but $75 for an ebook.
Yep.
And at those prices, the libraries just can't afford to be doing that.
It makes it tough on the libraries. They're getting gouged on prices.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and they're getting gouged on prices at a time when libraries are being forced to tighten their belts. You know, that it's tough to maintain the funding.
Because it's curious to me what their strategy is, those big five, as you call them, what their strategy is by doing that.
Well, their strategy is short-sighted. The fear of the large publishers is that if they sell ebooks to libraries, that the libraries, you know, won't have to replace the books because the books will never wear out. And they're worried that library ebook sales will cannibalize print sales to libraries and also cannibalize ebook sales and print sales through traditional retail. I think the fears are unfounded. I think there's plenty of evidence out there that shows that libraries are drivers of readership and help increase your overall sales at retail.
It'll work itself out. It's just going to take some more time because the industry's so new and they're scared. It's like anything else. It's change and unknown, and they're scared and they don't want to lose their marketplace. Yeah. And so they're trying to put the screws to somebody they can put the screws to, and they won't be able to do that forever, and it'll work itself out.
Yeah, you're right. It will work itself out. What, you know, libraries are discovering that the indie author and small publisher community is serving them in ways that the large publishers are not, which means that, you know, the indie community is going to start taking market share from the big publishers. I think eventually the publishers will come to their senses and treat libraries with a little more respect.
Well, so now how can people get a hold of you or see how to use your services? I know that you know, a lot of businesses and entrepreneurs listen to my podcast, and I think for branding purposes, it could be a really smart avenue for them. And there's so many people out there that have thought about writing a book and just are kind of afraid to. And so where can they find more information about Smashwords and how to, and your book? You said they can get that anywhere.
Yeah. Well, you can go to Smashwords, smashwords.com, sign up for an account. It's free. And then the email that we send you will tell you all of your next steps. And it'll also provide you links to all three of the books that I wrote. So I mentioned The Secrets to eBook Publishing Success. So that'll teach you the best practices. I also wrote a book called The Smashwords Book Marketing Guide. That'll give you about 40 different marketing ideas, all of which are free for you to implement. And then the third book is The Smashwords Style Guide, which teaches you how to format and publish an ebook. So, you know, between those three books, you will become an expert on ebook self-publishing. If you have not yet written your book, I would encourage you to attend a local writers conference. You know, here on the West Coast in California, there's the San Francisco Writers Conference, which is an awesome conference, and people come from all around the world to it. But there are a lot of other great regional writers conferences. Go to these writers conferences and soak up, you know, as much knowledge as you can about the business of publishing so that you can publish with greater success.
Okay. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us. I think your words of wisdom will help a lot of people.
Well, thanks, Sarah. I appreciate you having me on your show, and good luck to you.
Okay. Well, have a wonderful day.
All right. Take care.
Yep.
All right. Bye.
Well, I think that the really neat thing about talking to Mark Kolker is it really shows that anyone can publish. And if you're a business owner and you want to use publishing as a way to get your word out and you have something to share with the world, with your service, and you need a platform for getting that information out, I think it's a great way to go. Self-publish a book, and maybe you can get some clients off that. It's a lot of work, but it could really pay off, especially if you have something really great to share with the world. Okay, so now we're going to have Elad Levinson join us, and he's going to talk about thriving on change and what's missing in leadership today. So now let's welcome Elad Levinson.
Hi, Elad. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, of course. You have some interesting things here that we want to talk about. First of all, there really is a shortage of leadership in this country, and I think we're seeing it just on all fronts, especially with just the bad behavior that's going on in our country, the corruption, and you know, people having a loss of confidence in our institutions, which is really a clear sign of lack of leadership.
Yep.
What do you have to say about that? What is your take on that?
Well, first of all, Sarah, I would say it's not a U.S. phenomena. I'm spending a lot of time talking to leaders outside the United States, and they're resonating very much with the that phrase that there's a lack of leadership or that there's a lack of succession. And a good example of that is the Henley study that came from the School of Management in the UK, which described the extraordinary gap between what was expected of leaders and the competencies they had, and also the lack of prepared people for C-suite or for senior level leadership. I think that just talking about it from an organizational point of view, I think there are two reasons that I'd like to highlight. One of them is that development as a strategy for organizations is really shared by only 50% of the organizations in the United States or maybe even in the world. So what that means is that you come into an organization and the expectation is that you're going to hit the ground running, that you're going to get what, you know, that old expression, kind of throw them in the lake and see if they swim. And you know, managers are not really trained to think about developing their people.
Well, they're not even hiring people that way anymore. Everything's more of like a farming out based on skills and how, right. And they just want to use them when they can and then get rid of them. I mean, that's the whole concept now.
Well, and just think about it for a moment that there's kind of a divide in the world in terms of the attitude that we're talking about. On one side, you have companies that are oriented towards development. So an example of that would be the entire technology sector. And the reason for that is that if you're not going to retain top talent, and there is a talent war for people who are in technology fields, if you don't develop them. And so companies have maybe grudgingly and maybe sometimes have really, you know, stepped up to having a development philosophy, which means that managers are looking at their employees and saying, how can I help you learn? Then, so there, the technology sector is not the only place this happens. It really is, kind of, you know, or, sector to sector, companies really define themselves as either places where you're going to develop people because you have to create a pipeline, a succession, or there are companies who are like you're talking about, Sarah, who really look at employees as commodities. And it's plug and play, and I'll put you here and use this skill. The dilemma, I think, for a lot of companies is that if you don't have a development point of view or a philosophy, then you also are not going to keep people engaged. And if you don't keep people engaged, then they're not going to be productive or loyal.
Well, and you think that they pretty much just look for what benefits them. We've kind of got to this what benefits me culture instead of how do we do something that's good for the community at large and for our company? Make money, of course, but do it in a way that is good for everyone and just look at more stewardship and versus people just looking to see how they can benefit day one or, you know, right away and move on. It's just a very focused, you know, go ahead.
No, I think that you're making a really excellent point. And again, this, for me, this is the divide. So you have, I have a very close relationship with the Center for Positive Organizational Scholarship at University of Michigan in the Ross School of Business. What they do is they study companies that are dedicated to two things. Number one, cultivating positive emotional states within their organization. They focus on people being happy. They focus on people feeling connected to each other. They focus on compassion and treating people with warmth and kindness. And there are hundreds of companies like this, Sarah. And those companies are also the same ones who tend to be oriented towards the community and see themselves as stewards rather than exploiters.
Yeah, and do they typically do better? Has there been any?
Yes.
So
yes,
they can match profit margins to that kind of attitude because the people are healthier and
yes,
the company's healthier. And so therefore they are rewarded by just having a healthier balance sheet.
Well, there actually is quite a bit of research that's been done by people who are in the investment community about companies that have distinct advantages with regard to their stock price or to their profitability. And two of the factors that have been pointed out in study after study is, number one, that they treat employees in the way that we've been talking about. They really are concerned about employee engagement. They're really concerned about people wanting to work at where they're working and also to give more than just to the organization, but back to the community. And the second factor is that they really work with managers learning how to develop people, because as a manager, it's very easy to be a working manager, right? You see yourself as an individual contributor.
Exactly.
And instead of somebody who's really there to develop their people.
Well, and you have to really do it, right? It can't just be you see so many companies that are advertising like they're doing it, but everybody knows that it's not real. It's the companies that are really doing it, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that we could draw an analogy to the corporate social responsibility field. There are many companies that are guilty of what's called greenwashing, right? So they basically present themselves because they do one thing, and they tout that as if they were a socially responsible company. So yeah, I think that you're absolutely right about that.
And it kind of all ties in. I know that boards that have more diversity, and not just a token diversity, but actually 3 to 4, you know, people on it, like 3 or 4 females and more diversity, actually have double digit higher profit margins. And I would think that ties into you just treating people better.
Yes, I think it does treat into, well, I think there's a very direct correlation, and that is that you have a respect for differences.
Exactly.
And that has a lot to do with being a development culture, because if you really truly are an organization that respects the differences in people's talents, then you look for their strengths and you grow their strengths while you find people to kind of balance other people's weaknesses.
Well, you also focus on other topics like emotional intelligence. Why do you think emotional intelligence is so important?
Well, it has a lot to do with what I've been studying over the last 25 years, and that is that there's been a tremendous bias in organizations. The bias is we don't see ourselves as being interested in anything that goes on beyond the skin of an individual. Look, just show up, do your work, and do it right. And I think that the emotional intelligence was a breakthrough. You know, now it's been almost 20 years.
Sure.
In this whole area of recognizing that people tend to be more competent, they tend to be more capable, and they certainly are much easier to collaborate with if they have emotional intelligence. And so now there's a growing correlation between high quality relationships and productivity.
Well, and don't you think with the stress, the change that's going on in the workplace, just the amount of change and the amount of stress, emotional intelligence is just that much more important?
Well, yeah, let's take an example. So one of the kind of very powerful phrases or terms that have come out of the Harvard Business Review recently is VUCA, V-U-C-A, and it stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. So these are just building on what you were talking about with regard to, you know, change. These are qualities of change that leaders are dealing with. When you're emotionally intelligent, one of the skills in emotional intelligence is being able to step back from your reactions and do what's called self-regulation. So, you know, you're in a situation, it's very complex, you have to make a decision, you have to do it within a certain time frame, there's urgency associated with it, and you can begin to feel the heat kind of rising, you know, your face getting flushed, and you begin to feel that kind of sense of like, am I going to make the right decision? If you're emotionally intelligent, you recognize this, you're able to calm yourself down, that's the self-regulation piece, and then make that decision from a much more conscious and intelligent way.
And not just reacting towards people
and
being abusive or whatever your stress will cause you to be. But that gets back to, you know, we're talking about change and things, and you have a class and you have things that you do with people thriving on change. And what is it? That's your focus right now, right? Is just working.
Yes, it is.
What is thriving on change? I mean, I know what thriving on change is, and I think people need to, you know, really embrace that concept. But what do you think thriving on change is, and how are you presenting it to people?
Well, thank you for asking. So here's my basic assumption, is that the human brain needs to evolve to be able to deal with what we just talked about, that volatility and the VUCA. And so how do you help the brain deal with the need to grow capacity and to increase skill? And my assertion is that there are three underlying skill sets that change the game completely. The first one is mindful awareness, and very simply what it means is being able to track moment-to-moment changes inside yourself and with others so that you're more aware of what you need to do to be responsive instead of reactive. That's number one. Number two, and this comes directly from Daniel Goleman's work and his book Focus, that we need to learn how to train the brain to be able to focus attention at will, keep it in a particular place, but also to release it when it no longer is necessary to be there. People become hyper-focused, and they don't know how to relax. And so that's the second big
skill
set.
That's important, because I think that causes a lot of anxiety behind people if they're just so focused, and then they're focused beyond the necessary, and it causes that stress again, and then anxiety. Yes, okay.
Yes, thank you. And then the third big skill set is generating and cultivating goodwill. So my experience is that When you work inside an organization, of course, this would be true in Congress also.
Oh, yeah.
It's constant conflict. I mean, basically, there's differences of opinion. People have strong emotions about conversations, and things are important to people. And so if you don't know how to navigate the world of conflict and to do it gracefully and effectively, you're really not going to be able to be a really strong leader. And so the whole third section is about how to, first of all, turn your attitude towards kindness and warmth towards people. But then it gets really down to a very kind of gritty subject, which is how do you carry on conversations where you have to be assertive and effective? And secondly, how do you deal with difficult conversations that you absolutely have to have? Because if you don't, you're not going to really be able to make progress.
Well, if people are interested in seeing more about this, where can they go?
Well, thanks. The website that they would go to is morethansound, that's all one word, morethansound.net. And when they get there, they'll see Thriving on Change, which will be a part of something called Praxis U, which is the streaming video portion of More Than Sound.
Okay. Well, interesting. I think it's really great because my whole show, Business Game Changers, is about embracing this change that's occurring, not just embracing it, but also getting in front of it and making sure that we're going in the right direction as a country, because there's a lot of problems too. And I think it's important for people to be able to have a heightened awareness of what's going on so that we can make a difference and do things in a more positive direction. There's some serious things that we need to deal with. So go ahead.
I think that that's the operative word right there, becoming conscious and really being able to name what the problems are rather than looking at things that are false causes or looking at things that are symptoms and not the root cause.
Exactly. We got to get past that and get to the real deal and get things done. And that takes leadership and understanding and also not being afraid of change as well, because,
that's right.
You know, sometimes the change that we need change right now. We need change in a lot of ways, and we need to figure it out. But I appreciate so much you coming on the show, and I'll have your information on my webpage and on my radio show page so people can get to it.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Okay, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Remember, if you want to find information on how to contact my guests, go to my website at www.sarahwestall.com. And remember, when you're there, please share on Facebook and like my page on Facebook. We need to get the word out on all these great guests that I'm having. And if you want to also see my radio page, you can always go to webtalkradio.net and find me there. And I also have all the contact information there as well. Okay, so now all of you have a wonderful day.